From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. Today on the show, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mary Burke says she would try to roll back parts of Act 10 if she's elected.
I want to restore the right to collectively bargain, and I do want to make sure that folks in the public sector are competitively paid so that we are able to attract and keep good people, and that we have the accountability around that, though.
A new report looks at why the comeback of the Menominee Valley has been a success. Plus, what do the participants at tomorrow's UN climate summit hope to accomplish?
They hope to do some groundwork to kind of guarantee that the countries will have significant, meaningful plans in the works in advance of the Paris meeting the following year.
And we'll chat with Illinois novelist Rebecca Mackay. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today. It was an up-and-down week for Democrat Mary Burke and her campaign for governor. Midweek tracking polls continue to show her neck and neck with Governor Walker, with just over a month remaining until the election. But on Friday, her campaign got bogged down with allegations that parts of her employment plan were lifted from other candidates for office from other states. The plans were all reportedly written by a policy consultant with whom the campaign subsequently cut ties. It remains to be seen whether the issue will have an impact on voters. Meanwhile, Mary Burke joins us this morning by phone from Madison. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thanks, Mitch. It's great to be on your show and to be with your listeners.
So your campaign got some positive news last week and some unwelcome attention last week with these reports that seem to show the author of part of your employment platform had borrowed from his own work on other campaigns. The positive news was that the race is still too close to call, if you will, and appears to be in the hands of a few undecided voters. So let's talk about those undecided voters and that other story. What's the message you would hope those voters take from last week's snafu and how your campaign responded to it?
Mitch, I've been clear, or I want to be really clear about this, is that my jobs plan has been based on my experience as an executive with Trek Bicycle, the division that I led there. We increased sales from $3 million to over $50 million, and that was in a few short years. I also started my own business, so I know the challenges that entrepreneurs face and also how we can overcome those challenges for small businesses to grow, which are the backbone of Wisconsin's economy. So it's based on that experience, but also I drew from best practices all over the country on how we can make sure that Wisconsin's economy is moving forward. For example, I sat down with Michael Porter, who is a guru known worldwide for his work in using industry clusters to grow strong sectors of our industry, both emerging ones and existing ones. And so that work is included in my Invest for Success jobs plan and how I would align our economic and public policy efforts around strong industry clusters, and I cite Michael Porter's work in that. I also used a consultant, Eric Schnur, who through his consulting firm specializes in public policy development, economic development proposals, innovative ideas, and research around those ideas. And the thing that was wrong was Eric used some very similar language, some exact wording that he had used in other plans that he had provided to other campaigns. And that's wrong, and that's why we cut ties with his firm.
At this point, has your campaign done its own analysis to ensure there aren't other instances of unattributed work? There's a report out this morning that points to a handful of other phrases in other areas.
Well, Mitch, my jobs plan is about 45 pages long. In addition, we have I've put out a rural plan on how we can make sure that rural communities around the state are growing and thriving, which has been a real issue. We've lost nearly 9,000 farms over a five-year period of time. And so I want to make sure that the people of Wisconsin understand the type of governor I'm going to be and the plans I have for moving the state forward. I am going to draw on best practices and innovative ideas that are working in other parts of the country. But these plans are fairly in-depth, and what has been identified are very small passages scattered throughout that that have maybe been used in other plans that this consultant developed. So this is something that is extremely limited, and the main bulk of this work is work that I have been deeply involved with. And there are not ideas in those plans unless I thought that they're great ideas for Wisconsin on how we're going to move our economy forward.
Okay, so while we're on the subject of employment, let's use the opportunity to talk a little bit more about what's in your employment plan. Where do you see Wisconsin's employment picture today?
Well, the latest numbers released just this last week unfortunately show that Wisconsin is dead last in the Midwest in terms of job creation under Governor Walker. So the last 3.5 years and out of 10 Midwestern states, our job growth is 10th. And in fact, in the month of August, the preliminary numbers show we lost 4,300 jobs. So his strategies are not working, and that's why, based on my business experience, I have put forth the ideas that I have. Mitch, what I'm interested in is making sure that Wisconsin is a top 10 thriving economy, and the ideas we need to consider and we need to focus on are the ones that should work. I don't care whether ideas are Democratic or Republican ideas. I just care about whether they have a good chance of working. So let's go with those ideas. Let's bring people together, because the challenges we have and we face are immense, but they're ones I know that we can overcome if we do work together and we focus on the priorities.
So obviously a lot was made of Governor Walker's pledge to create 250,000 jobs in the 4 years of his term. The most independent analyses of progress put the actual numbers at less than half of that, about 40% in the analysis of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel just recently. Where do you think the governor's approach was wrong in terms of job creation?
Well, the governor seems to think, because he did outline in his, when he made that promise in 2010, his jobs plan was all of 4 pages long. And frankly, if you took out the pictures of himself, it was closer to 2. And really, we deserve more thought and research and best practices if we're going to be able to drive Wisconsin's economy forward and have a thriving economy and meet the promises that he made, which was the 250,000 jobs. It's pretty simple. What he outlines in that plan is he generally believes that you give tax breaks to those at the top and the special interests, and somehow it trickles down and creates jobs. Well, I'm a business person. That's not how jobs get created. Jobs get created when you have a healthy economy where people have money to spend, where they're buying, they're going to restaurants, they're buying goods and services or new cars. And when they do that, then companies hire more people to meet that expanded demand. That's how actually jobs get created. So what we have seen is that under Governor Walker, not only are our jobs lagging, but our personal consumption, so the money that people are spending, is lagging as well, which means people are not going out. They don't have the ability to spend money in our local economy. So it's a flawed model, and I have a very different model, and I lay out in my jobs plan the 5 core strategies on how we're going to do this. It means we need to have a more entrepreneurial climate in Wisconsin. That's one of them. Right now, we're 46th in the country in terms of new businesses started, and it is new business and small business growth that account for nearly 70% of the jobs created. Over the past 4 years, I've mentored a small business, a husband and wife business that making jam. And when I first started mentoring them, it was just the husband and wife, just 2 people. This summer, they were shipping their first nationwide orders to Crate and Barrel stores across the country. They're now up to about 10 full-time employees. They're looking at how they can continue to expand and to grow and hire more people. Those are the sorts of companies we need to have a lot more of in a variety of industries to make sure that we are growing. So it's entrepreneurism, it's exporting. The division I ran at Trek Bicycle was one that was selling great Wisconsin products all over the world, and that helped to create more good-paying jobs here. So I know firsthand experience how you export Wisconsin products and be able to create more jobs here by selling products around the world. So that's the second important one. But I outlined five core strategies. People can go to my website, burkeforwisconsin.com, to see the specifics of that jobs plan.
So what do you see it taking in this current business climate for companies like Trek to start hiring more people?
The most important thing is for companies to be innovative, to be able to hire a great workforce. And I hear that over and over and over again from business people. A lot of their success is tied to being able to hire qualified, innovative workforce, that our communities are attracting young people, because more and more these days, young people are deciding where they want to be rather than taking a job and then going to wherever that job is. So we need to have thriving communities throughout Wisconsin. And just a few weeks ago, I was in Eau Claire and visited a startup software company that is growing by just leaps and bounds. And in fact, in the last year, they've hired 100 people and just moved into this beautiful new office building that they built. And they have opened, they're in their 30s. They've opened locations in Australia and in China and doing just incredible work. So our university system, our education system, are really the drivers of our state's economy. And unlike Governor Walker, I believe in investing in our education system. Under Governor Walker, we have seen the largest cuts to education in the country. And not only our K-12 system, but our technical college system was reduced back to 1989 funding levels. And Governor Walker cut $250 million from our UW system. So as governor, I want to invest in education because I understand as a business person, it's the economic driver of our state.
Well, and so along the lines of education, school report cards came out last week and showed a similar divide to years past, stronger performances in suburban and rural communities, and slow gains, if any, at large urban school districts like Milwaukee Public Schools. What do you see as the way up for struggling districts like MPS?
Well, these are challenging issues, but they're ones that I'm ready to take on. And in fact, I have already taken these on and made significant progress in Madison. For the last 6 years, I have worked on creating a partnership between the Boys and Girls Club and the public schools that would open doors to teens, mainly from low-income families, who would be the first in their families to earn a college degree, either a two-year degree or a four-year. We have had great success so far. There are 750 teens in this program in our high schools and already 200 that have gone on to college. So I know we can do this work. It isn't easy. It does require partnerships. It requires a focus. It also requires accountability and having high standards. And I'm concerned that Governor Walker actually wants to turn back the higher standards that are now being worked on. They have been worked on for 3 years throughout the state. They're supported by the education community, also by the business community, to make sure the young people in Wisconsin, when they graduate, are able to compete with students in other states like Minnesota or even other countries. And that's what is really important in improving education, whether it's in Milwaukee, but also in our more rural, smaller school districts. And I travel around the state every day. I love visiting and talking with folks, hearing their ideas, but also their concerns. I visited with superintendents in Rhinelander and in Alma and all over the state. And unfortunately, some of the cuts to education that we have seen impact the rural school districts even greater than the urban school districts. They're really cutting to the bone, and the drop in school funding, in fact, nearly half of the school districts in Wisconsin for this school year, the 2014-15 school year, actually saw their state funding cut. And a lot of those are rural school districts with declining enrollment. So it's not just urban challenges that we have. We have to make sure that we are supporting our rural school districts as well.
And to go back to something you said just a moment ago in terms of the standards, you were talking about Common Core standards. And so a Burke administration would seek to keep the Common Core standards in place?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of misconceptions around Common Core. I serve on my local school board, so I'm pretty familiar with the issues. This is supported by not only the education community, but the business community. Right now, Wisconsin standards, unfortunately, are 38th in the country. So we have really low standards. And we have seen in other places in the country, when they raise their educational standards, they also raise the overall performance and achievement of their students. And so this is just a framework to make sure that what students are learning in second grade builds on first grade, and that goes on, and it all builds to where when you graduate from high school, you do have the critical thinking skills to enable you to get a good paying job or to take that next step and go on to technical college or university. But this is critical because right now, our standards are low, and I don't want Wisconsin students to be left behind. I want Wisconsin students to be leading the way.
The first major measure of the Walker administration was Act 10, and its results have been debated since it was passed. What has been the impact of Act 10 in your estimation?
Mitch, I am in favor of contributions to health care and to pension. That's what most workers in the private sector face, and so I think that that's only fair. But I also believe that public sector employees should have the right to collectively bargain. And that doesn't stand in the way of having effective and efficient and accountable government and schools. But we also have to make sure that we are able to attract and keep good people in our public sector. And I am concerned with some of the impact because I know from my work at Trek Bicycle, an organization is only as good as its people. And unfortunately, I hear stories about young people now leaving our state. And in fact, one gentleman in Neenah shared a story of his daughter who graduated from UW-Eau Claire in education, is going to be a teacher. She had two job offers, one in her hometown in Neenah and one in Minnesota. Well, guess which one she took? She took the one in Minnesota. And I said, Jim, how come? And he said, well, it wasn't only the starting pay, but it was her advancement prospects. And young people, if they're looking here in Wisconsin at all they can get is a 1% or 2% raise a year for the rest of their career, that's not even enough to really pay off those student loans, much less buy a house and raise a family. So I know from being an executive at Trek Bicycle, you have to make sure the overall compensation package is fair and competitive in order to attract and keep people. And that's not only the salary, but the benefits as well.
So you would seek to roll back at least parts of Act 10?
Well, I want to restore the right to collectively bargain, and I do want to make sure that folks in the public sector are competitively paid so that we are able to attract and keep good people, and that we have the accountability around that, though. To have a strong public sector, we have to hold people accountable.
Mary Burke, many thanks. I hope we'll talk to you again before the election.
I look forward to it, Mitch. Thanks very much.
Mary Burke is the Democratic candidate for governor of Wisconsin. We reached her by phone from Madison this morning. There remains an open invitation for Governor Walker to appear on this program as well. What can be learned from the turnaround of the Menominee Valley? A new report draws some conclusions, and we'll hear about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The turnaround in Milwaukee's Menominee Valley has been hailed by many as an example of what's possible for once blighted areas. Where once there were decaying factories, today there are new businesses, a park, a multi-use trail, and a hotel and casino. And the valley is bookended by Miller Park and the Harley-Davidson Museum. But a report just out this morning makes an effort to quantify just what went right with the valley and what lessons could be applied to other areas in Milwaukee that could be the next Menominee Valley. Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher with the Public Policy Forum and lead author of the report. Rob Henkin is president of the forum. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us. Yeah,
thanks for having us.
Your report says right from the top that its job is not to measure the success of the Menominee Valley's redevelopment, but to start with the premise that it has been successful. But at the risk of going off script here, why is that a given? How do we know that the valley's redevelopment has been a success?
We do start by presenting metrics that show the economic development, the environmental improvements, and the improvements to community integration and engagement that have occurred over the last 15 years. So while we start with the premise that it's been successful, we do present data at the beginning of the report that shows the progress that's been made.
Well, and for people who have not been here for that full 15 years, can you give us a snapshot of what the valley was before this began and what we see out there today?
The valley was a largely abandoned, blighted industrial area in the 1990s. There were numerous vacancies. A lot of the land was contaminated. There was frequent flooding, blighted buildings. There were a lot of issues that were affecting the redevelopment potential of the valley after having previously been a real center of jobs for the region. So today we've seen a lot of jobs come back to the valley. A lot of the land has been cleaned up. We have new parks and infrastructure. So we've really seen a real community revitalization take place.
And Mitch, sprinkled throughout the report, which is available on the forum's website, we have some before and after photos, which are quite interesting to see. They don't make for good radio, but your listeners can certainly access the report on our website.
Well, and the report was commissioned by the group Menominee Valley Partners, which is the nonprofit that spearheaded a lot of this work in concert with other groups. But the message of the report is clearly directed at future redevelopment efforts in other parts of the city. Can you speak to the aim of this work?
So this was actually a wonderful opportunity for the Public Policy Forum because Menominee Valley Partners came to us. They are in the midst of some strategic planning. And one of the very important things for them is that people tend to think when they go to the valley and just see this remarkable revitalization that the job is complete. And it isn't. There are still some undeveloped lands. In the recent past, we have seen Cargill announce that it is leaving the valley. So there's still much more work to be done in the valley, and Menominee Valley Partners wanted an independent third party to come in and assess, hey, what worked in terms of our previous efforts and why did those things work? So a very important opportunity for us to help in that important effort. But at the same time, we think there are much broader lessons that may have resonance for several other major redevelopment projects in this community, ranging from Century City to the Inner Harbor to other brownfields type sites.
And Century City is what some people also refer to as the 30th Street Corridor.
Yes, the former Tower Automotive site.
So this coalesces in seven key areas you describe. And at the top is the notion of a common vision. Who has to be involved in the development of that vision? And how does consensus have to take place? What is the lesson from Menominee Valley's experience here?
We saw that a more comprehensive planning and visioning process was undertaken in the valley than had previously been done in other areas of the city. That involved not only the city creating a land use, marketing, and engineering plan for the valley, but also involved community organizations, the 16th Street Community Health Center, and the Menominee Valley Partners that helped to create not only a land use plan, but policies to guide the quality of the development, the environmental sustainability of the redevelopment.
Well, and let me ask you that. I mean, how does consensus have to take place in this?
That was another aspect that we noted was that the process really engaged the community to a larger extent, perhaps having not only the city effort, but having – there were a design charrette. There were numerous events that were undertaken that really brought in design professionals and brought in the larger community to get their perspective on what should be done in the valley.
And so the idea is that it gave the stakeholders some image in their head of what we're working towards.
Exactly. I think that the process brought about that vision of what could really take place here. And having that sort of vision, we heard, was very important to getting the community on board as well as getting funders on board.
Does this separate from the notion of developing the public-private partnerships and intergovernmental cooperation, or is that part of the common visioning process? I mean, do those partnerships and government entities enter the picture after the consensus has developed?
Some of that took place during the planning process itself, but it continued to advance as projects were developed in the Valley. So as projects were being implemented, partnerships were formed between various levels of government, between Valley businesses, Menominee Valley Partners, and other private sector organizations as well. So it really was both.
And I think one of the real important aspects of having this powerful vision that people could latch onto was the fact that it did get multiple layers of government on board early, and it allowed them to stay on board. And what's really remarkable from an intergovernmental cooperation perspective is that the 10 years or so that we studied, we had three different mayors of the city of Milwaukee during that period. We had three different governors of the state of Wisconsin. It didn't matter who was in office. State and city worked together very closely on this project, and that clearly is something that doesn't always occur.
Well, I was going to say, Rob Henkin, you have been in and around government in this city and in this community for quite some time. Does this project particularly stand out in your mind about what is possible?
I think without question it does, Mitch. And I do see that despite the politics that exist and the fact that we have a mayor and a governor who have been political opponents in two different elections, we are seeing it in terms of economic development elsewhere. The whole plan for the lakefront and the changes to 794 and so on is another good example where the county and the city and the state are rolling up their sleeves together. Century City, I think we'd perhaps like to see a little more of that. On paper, they are working together. But I think economic development is one of those issues that can transcend ideology and politics. So there's nobody who's against economic development, and I don't think there's anybody who doesn't understand that you need multiple layers of government and multiple funders to get big projects done.
Now, brownfields are a significant issue in both areas that are being talked about, so Century City and also the Inner Harbor and probably other places as well. What are the specific issues linked to these blighted places that need to be taken on, and whose responsibility should they be?
The environmental contamination that affects brownfields properties makes it difficult to redevelop them because of the cost of cleaning up the land, of course. And in the Valley and in other areas of the city, there are multiple issues that are not only about the environmental contamination, but have to do with the stability of the soil, have to do with flooding, other issues as well. It's an interesting question of who should be responsible for it. I think it's proven very difficult, or I should say it's proven the case that the city had to really step in most cases to provide funding and to attract funding from the state and federal governments in order to really address those issues and make the sites shovel ready.
This is the maxim that you have to spend money to make money?
Well, and it really speaks to the issue of risk, and it's a tough one for the public policy forum. We're obviously a fiscal watchdog, and we monitor budgets very closely. And it's difficult for us to urge city government, which has a series of structural long-term budgetary problems through no fault of its own, to take on financial risk, to go out and purchase properties when there isn't a developer in sight yet. But I think one of the messages of this report is that if we do want to be serious about cleaning up brownfields properties, there is going to have to be that element. It should be informed risk-taking. But this report is suggesting that without the city having been willing to take risk in the Valley, this may not have occurred, or at least may not have occurred as comprehensively and as quickly.
You look at the Menominee Valley, and it is not just businesses that are there. There are, you know, entertainment centers, which I guess are also businesses, but also parks. Does redevelopment necessarily have to cast a broad net to be successful?
I think it's one of the important dimensions of this project that it did. It's unusual. This was not just about job creation and tax-based growth. This was about building a better community and improving the quality of life for city residents. To me, at least, I think you need to sort of look at these projects one by one. You can see how the Inner Harbor could potentially take on similar overtones. Perhaps with Century City, that's going to be more geared toward a traditional economic development model. But who am I to say that?
The holistic approach that was taken to redeveloping the Valley really, I think, brought in a lot more community support, because there were a lot of different goals that were being undertaken simultaneously.
What should our expectations be when we're talking about an initiative like this in terms of job creation? Does there need to be more than just the opportunity to open businesses? I mean, what does it say in terms of, for example, workforce development?
One of the goals of the Valley was really to connect the development with providing jobs for the surrounding community and to provide high-quality jobs that were family-supporting wages. That was a common theme. That's been achieved in some ways and not in others. We have seen that the wages in the Valley have gone up, but it's been more difficult to really provide large numbers of jobs for residents of the surrounding neighborhoods where unemployment is an issue. And that's a lesson learned, we felt, from the Valley, that there may need to be more work for other similar projects to attract businesses that will employ neighborhood residents and also to provide more job training targeted towards those residents.
Without question, one of the unique elements of this revitalization was that there was a great degree of specificity in terms of the types of jobs. So it wasn't just about creating X number of jobs, but it was about creating these very specific jobs with family-supporting wages. And that was not without controversy. You may recall that there was the Bi-Seasons controversy. The Bi-Seasons company wanted to locate in the Menominee Valley, and ultimately that was rejected because those jobs were not felt to be of the type that were targeted for this specific area of the city.
Even given what we see as the Valley's success, it is still facing challenges, as you say. What can we learn from how it's approaching those challenges as we look towards, you know, potential future development?
I think that one difficulty in the Valley is that a lot of the remaining land, they are still brownfield properties and they're more dispersed. So they're of individual ownership and there's a lot more challenges that have to be overcome in terms of acquiring those sites, putting them together in order to redevelop them.
And it really – this speaks to the fact that we do have lots of exciting projects going on in various parts of the city. And I think one of the reasons the Valley was able to take shape the way it did was that this was essentially priority number one. I think one of the dangers here, and I know that Menominee Valley Partners is concerned, is that, again, they no longer make it on the priority list because they've had so much success. So to the extent that there's going to have to be some very specific attention and risk-taking by various levels of government, is that going to be possible while similar considerations are being made for redevelopment projects in other parts of the city?
Interesting questions. Well, thanks to both of you for shedding some light on them for us.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you.
Rob Henkin is president of the Public Policy Forum, and Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher and lead author of the forum's report on the Menominee Valley. It was done independently but commissioned by the group Menominee Valley Partners. By now, you've probably heard of tomorrow's UN Climate Summit, but what's actually likely to come out of it? We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The August data from the National Climatic Data Center shows that the planet experienced its hottest June, July, and August on record. The news comes as 120 heads of state and other representatives are coming to New York for tomorrow's United Nations Climate Summit. It'll be addressed by dignitaries from Al Gore to Leonardo DiCaprio. George Stone teaches natural sciences at Milwaukee Area Technical College, and he joins us periodically to talk about climate change and other issues. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be back, and thanks for inviting me.
So we're talking on the eve of a significant summit at the United Nations on climate. Who is represented at this summit, and what are they hoping to accomplish from it?
Well, this summit was called by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon of the United Nations, and they're hoping to get more preparatory work done in advance of COP21. Now, these COP meetings, stands for Conference of Parties, are the annual meetings under the auspices of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was first developed back in the early 90s in conjunction with the Earth Summit down in Rio. And this will be the 20th meeting is taking place in Lima, Peru this December. But the 21st meeting is the one that everyone's looking forward to in Paris the following year in December of 2015.
And what makes that such a significant meeting that people are already overlooking the one that's happening this winter and looking to 2015?
Well, they set that one as kind of a deadline conference for the participating countries to develop plans and come up with suggestions. So everyone's kind of looking forward to that one, hoping that there'll be some significant agreement on ways of, on a global basis, reducing greenhouse gas emissions and addressing the climate change challenge.
This is presumably when each of the countries says, this is what we are willing and able to do to negate or to help lessen the impact of climate change.
That's right. And it comes down to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, especially carbon dioxide, which, of course, translates into transitioning away from the heavy use of fossil fuels, especially coal, that we are presently committed to. And this meeting that the Secretary General called this coming week on the 23rd, this summit, they hope to do some groundwork to kind of guarantee that the countries will have significant, meaningful plans in the works in advance of the Paris meeting the following year.
Now, there are big players who will be absent from this event on Tuesday, including China and India, as well as Australia. China and India are enormous contributors to global emissions.
Indeed.
Can any useful discussion of climate happen without them present and a part of it, or is part of the effort that we're going to see this week to try to drag them to the table, if you will?
Well, it's a way of leveraging their participation. The more unanimity we get among the other nations, the more pressure it puts on China and India. And, of course, their markets, their economies depend to a great extent, especially China, on the rest of the world. And so I think although they are reluctant, they are continuing to develop their economies, and they see that that's tied to, at least for present, to the use primarily of fossil fuels as an energy source. China is aware of the problem. They're investing a lot in renewable energy. We tend to talk about their reluctance to reduce the dependence on coal. They are phasing out their old inefficient coal plants. They're bringing online much more efficient, cleaner coal plants. And they're investing a lot more than we are in renewable energy. So we can't fault them too much.
Well, and so what is the greatest hope that you and others concerned about climate change have for what comes out of this summit? Is anything concrete likely to happen, or is this really kind of almost a pep rally?
Well, it is a pep rally in a sense, but then a pep rally gets the audience hyped up and oftentimes influences the result. And so that's what we're hoping for. There have been a number of reports that have come out recently this year which underline the importance of taking meaningful action to address the climate change challenge.
Well, and so let's talk about what the most recent data is saying.
Well, the most recent report, of course, this year, starting last year, last September, a year ago, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, released the first of its four parts of its fifth assessment report. The first assessment report was done way back in 1992. And they come out with a new assessment report about every 6 or 7 years. This has been going on now more than 20 years, involves altogether up to 200 countries, 2,000 climate scientists. It's really the largest physical science research project in the history of humankind. And the results each time, each six-year period, this time the fifth assessment report, the results underscore the findings of the previous report and give even stronger warnings that the impacts, the results, the outcomes that were predicted before are occurring, and they're occurring either even faster than we expected before, and the impacts and changes during this century and that are already being felt are greater than previously predicted. So each new – now that came out – the first part came out a year ago. That was the physical science basis. Then early in this year, the impacts report came out. The mitigation report has come out. And now most recently this summer, just a few weeks ago, the synthesis report, synthesizing all these earlier. These are massive amounts of data and studies, and they all indicate that we've really got to – the glaciers are melting faster. The sea level's rising faster than we expected. The frequency and intensity of extreme weather and climate events is increasing, And this is supported by all the data from the big reinsurance companies. So the latest IPCC Fifth Assessment Report underscores the need. More recently, just last week, the World Meteorological Organization issued its annual gas report, atmospheric gas report. And this indicates that it's even worse than we had previously thought. The amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is now up over 400 parts per million. It's increased 42 to 43% since the Industrial Revolution began 200 years ago. Methane is way up, 153%. Methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas, absorbs more heat than the carbon dioxide. Nitrous oxide's up. And along with that, with the World Meteorological Report, an area that's not usually emphasized, and that's ocean acidification. Ocean acidification, the ocean's becoming more acid at a greater rate than at any time in the last 300 million years. I mean, it's really kicking up.
Well, now, and how is that linked to climate?
Well, carbon dioxide, which is the principal greenhouse gas, and it's the principal cause of that is the combustion of fossil fuels, carbon-based fuels. That carbon dioxide, some of it, about 40%, dissolves in the ocean. Like there's carbon dioxide in beer and soft drinks and champagne. And that carbon dioxide in the ocean, it reacts with water and produces carbonic acid, which ionizes, makes the ocean more acidic, lowers the pH of the ocean. The oceans, the world's oceans, are becoming acidified. And this is extremely troubling. It's putting under stress a lot of the ecosystems in the ocean, which has formed the base of the food chain for the planet. Especially corals, for example. So not only do these organisms, such as the algae that live in a symbiotic relationship with the coral animals, the zooxanthellae, they're under stress not only from rising temperatures, but also from lowering pH, from increasing acidity in the oceans. So this is a very serious problem. In addition, it's a second effect of the carbon dioxide increase in the atmosphere, the first being increasing temperature.
Now, we talked last year about your trip to Antarctica and how it informed your, I guess, on-the-ground understanding of the issue. You are recently, if I'm not mistaken, back from the Galapagos Islands.
Yeah, that was a great trip.
Off the coast of Ecuador. They are, of course, most known for being where Charles Darwin did much of his work in studying evolution. But where do they fall in studying climate?
Well, they're right on the equator, kind of the opposite from Antarctica, which is down near the pole. But the changes are evident there as well in the migrations of fish. Some fish are very temperature sensitive, and they're also pH sensitive. So their research there in the Galapagos supports what the research from the rest of the world is showing, in that the water temperature is rising. A lot of heat is being stored in the oceans. As you know, it takes a lot of heat to change the temperature of the oceans, and that's really occurring. The oceans are a major heat sink, and the radiative forcing has increased 34% since 1990. That's another new report, and it's part of the World Meteorological Society or organization's report. The amount of radiative forcing has increased 34% from 1990 to 2013. What that means is the energy balance of the planet, the amount of energy that we're retaining versus the amount that we're radiating into space. And we are gaining energy, gaining heat all the time, and a lot of that's being stored in the oceans and a lot of it in the deep ocean. So how can you have a situation where the planet is retaining more heat than it radiates without it warming the entire planet?
George Stone, thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
George Stone teaches natural sciences at Milwaukee Area Technical College, and he's organizer of the annual Sustainability Summit. He's also an occasional Lake Effect contributor. Chicago area writer Rebecca Mackay joins us after a break to talk about her latest novel, The 100-Year House. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. How do we learn who we are or who we aren't? How big a role does our family play in who we become? And how much can we successfully write our own histories or rewrite them? The possibility of reinvention lies at the heart of Rebecca Mackay's newest novel, The Hundred Year House. Part mystery, part family drama, part ghost story, and wholly engaging and entertaining, The Hundred Year House is set in a fictional house in the Midwest that once housed an artist's colony and which has many, many secrets left a century later. The novel also tells its stories in reverse, starting from the year 2000 and moving backward in sections to the beginning in 1900. The reader ends up knowing the full story, even as none of the characters do. Rebecca Mackay lives in Chicago but came to Milwaukee in August and explained to Bonnie North that, oddly enough, the book began with a focus on male anorexia.
Yeah, that's what it was. About 10 years back, I started a short story that was largely about these two couples that had moved in together in a coach house, a small sort of chauffeur's house on a large estate. And the man of one of the couples was anorexic, and the man in the other couple was the only one who noticed and was trying to get everyone to realize what was going on. It did not work as a short story, but what I loved about the setup and why I came back to it then a few years later was this idea of the smaller house on a large estate. How 100 years ago, those little places were built, especially in the Midwest, get them a lot down in Chicago where I am, some of the suburbs up in Milwaukee here, you have some too. They were built as houses for chauffeurs, servants. Now that's not who lives in it at all. No one has a chauffeur anymore. And even if you're a billionaire, it's in-laws now. It's you rent it out to people. And I like the idea of that changing relationship over time between the people in the little house and the people in the big house. And I like the characters I had. But yeah, the anorexia thread eventually got cut out of the novel.
Well, and yes, you have the coach house, you have the big estate, you have the changing relationships of people. The other thing that I found very interesting is the claustrophobia.
Yeah.
The fact that all of these people were mushed together, in this case, reluctantly.
Right. You have this one huge mansion where we meet Z. She's one of the main characters in the first section of the book in 1999. And it's her mother who's living in this big house. Her mother offers her and her husband the coach house, but then really quickly moves another couple in there too without ever thinking to offer them space in the big house. That would never occur to her, right? And they're crammed together. They don't know each other very well. And they're moved into this tiny space. They're sharing a kitchen. They're sharing a living space. And of course, weird things happen. It's a weird house anyway. There are weird vibes there. People are unhappy. There's weird energy. But even in addition to that, just the sexual politics of two couples living in close proximity. A couple of them are out of work. They're hanging around the house together all day. They're not the two that are married to each other.
Of course.
Things happen.
Right. And there's also one is an artist, mm-hmm. and this house had been an artist colony. And
right.
that's part of the history, which we learn right away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not a secret.
Right. We know we're going to be moving backwards in time over the course of this book. We start in 1999, then we go back to the 50s, then we go back to the 20s, when this estate was an artist's colony in full swing, the kind of place where artists, writers, musicians would come and stay for a couple weeks, a couple months, and do their work. And these places are still around. There are some in the Midwest. But what's interesting to one of the characters in 1999, Z's husband, Doug, he's been trying since graduate school to write a book about this poet, Edwin Parfitt. And he knows that Edwin Parfitt once stayed at the colony. And he almost feels like as if by being so close to where Edwin Parfitt stayed, somehow magically that's going to help him write this, which of course is ridiculous until it's not.
When you were playing with these two couples and it turned in, you know, the anorexia thread went away and it turned into the 100-year house, did the idea of moving backward in time come with it, or was that something you always had in mind before you even started?
It came a little later, actually. So I had this idea of these two couples in this coach house, the big estate, maybe the idea that this house had been an artist's colony, the sense of some mystery in the background. And I realized that was going to be a novel. It wasn't a short story. And I started writing that as a novel. But I was going to have to leave a lot of things unanswered. They were going to bring up these mysteries of the past, wonder about them, try to find the files of the colony. And the ultimate message of the book was kind of going to be, well, we'll never know. And how unsatisfying is that? That real life is like that. And real life isn't always fun that way. I wanted to go down the rabbit hole. And I realized one day, I was brushing my teeth. I realized I could actually take them back in time. I could go back to the 50s when something kind of violent and cataclysmic happened. I could go back to the 20s when it was a colony. And at the very end, I could even go back to 1900 when the estate was being built. And that scared the hell out of me. I realized, you know, I was cutting out a lot more work for myself.
Oh, okay.
You know, I was like, oh, I'm almost done. I have the whole thing plotted out. And then I'm standing brushing my teeth going, wait, I could do this. And it's going to take me 3 more years to do it, but it was worth it.
I love the idea of going backward. The thing that kind of was melancholy for me is that knowing that the characters in that first section aren't ever going to know what I knew at the end of the book.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. In a lot of ways, you know, it's a story that is in some ways a ghost story and in some ways not. No ghost is going to pop out at you, but there's always the question of ghosts, who's haunting the place. And one of the answers, I think, to that question is that we are the ghosts, the readers. We are the ones who have witnessed all of this history. We are the only ones who can put it together. And we're uniquely unable to convey that information to the people who need to know it. And that's the position a ghost is in. So, you know, there are other answers to that ghost story mystery, too, of who's haunting the house, who's pulling these people around. But one of the answers is us.
That's fascinating. I hadn't thought of it that way before. But, yeah, we can't tell them. We can't go back to the beginning of the book and say, wait.
Right.
I know what's happening.
And how badly do we want to? And that's what we imagine ghosts are doing, too, right? They have something they want to tell us. They know stuff we don't know. They've seen it all. And they can't tell us.
Art plays a huge role here, too, almost as important a role as the human characters. What art is, what we need to make it, what it needs in order to flourish. And, of course, this is an artist colony, but it's a reluctant one.
Yeah. You know, when we start in 1999, we have Doug, who's trying to write about a poet. And we have Miriam, the wife in this other couple, who is herself an artist. She's making collage out of sort of detritus, these weird mosaics. And Miriam has that energy, that same energy that the artist did back in 1929. And maybe that's the reason that things start to happen then in the house. It's the first time the house has really had an artist in it since the colony was shut down and turned back into a private residence. And you know, people don't understand her art. They don't understand what she's doing. People don't even understand why Doug would be writing about a poet. People keep thinking he is a poet. So there's sort of this conflict between the artists and what they want to do and the people who've earned the money that have made this kind of place possible, often not the same people.
Usually not the same people.
Usually not. Yeah. Usually not. Sometimes, you know, occasionally it is. And, yeah, when we go back to the 20s, we get this group of artists fighting for the colony's survival. The house has been turned into an artist's colony, but the DeVores, the family who owns the estate, still, even though it's a colony, are threatening to shut them down. And they're doing anything they can to keep it open. So it's very much a justification of art that's going on. They're fighting for the right and the need to produce their art, to show this person, this representative of the DeVore family who's come to shut them down, why it should stay open. And when that fails, they resort to some kind of fun foul play instead,
yes.
Actually.
Yes, and obviously things happen. Rebecca Mackay, thank you so much for stopping by.
Absolutely, thank you.
Rebecca Mackay's latest novel is The Hundred Year House, published by Viking. Mackay, who lives in Chicago, spoke with Bonnie North in August. That's Monday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Keep listening coming your way at 12 noon from WBUR in Boston and NPR. It's Here and Now, but right now it's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.